Welcome to Epilogue, the only show that cuts into the big issues behind the best books on politics and world affairs. I'm Derek Conway, and this week we're reviewing Interventions by Noam Chomsky, one of the world's leading American philosophers. In this epilogue, we'll review the book and the issues around it, but before I tell you about my studio guests, let's take a look at this brief introductory video.
Fierce and concise, Noam Chomsky presents in Interventions a variety of topics that demonstrate the continuing authoritarian abuses to which the United States has subjected the world, especially after the attack on New York on September 11th. Chomsky presents a collection of articles which talk about the occupation of Iraq, the Bush presidency, Israel and Palestine, the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, national security, and the growing threat of nuclear war. The book shows how the US used September the 11th as an excuse to attack Iraq, and the public support came from the Bush administration and the media confusing the American people into believing that Saddam Hussein was involved in the attack on the Twin Towers. All of this was in order to control the vast Iraqi oil reserves in exchange for hundreds and thousands of lives. The author also refers to Latin America and how they have become a hard nut to crack in the last two decades. Governments of different political tendencies have failed to budge and have become an obstacle to the US in its usual political and military interventions in local issues to acquire sway over the vast natural resources of the region. Today in Epilogue, we will discuss the points given by Noam Chomsky in his book, Interventions.
In this collection of 50 remarkable essays, Chomsky examines American policy on Iraq, the presidency of George Bush, the actions of Israel, and US challenges to Iran. But just how reasonable are these dissident observations of his own nation's foreign policy shortcomings? Chomsky is a professor at MIT, one of America's premier universities. He's written over 150 books and describes himself as a libertarian socialist. Well, to consider his views, I'm joined in the Press TV studios by Daniel Rennick, a writer, blogger, and organizer with recent publications in the Palestine Chronicle and Axis of Logic, and by Hisham Yezer, editor-in-chief of Ceasefire, a political and cultural magazine in the UK. Welcome to you both. Now, you plowed through Chomsky's work. I think you've probably read him before as a philosopher, but what is he? Is he a grumpy old man or is he a vital conscience of America? Daniel, what did you make of it?
I think he is a vital conscience of America. I think we all owe Chomsky a hell of a lot for what he's done in uncovering US abuses throughout his career. I mean, Chomsky has never stopped. He's relentless in that approach. And Arundhati Roy refers to him as Chomsky, because you put Chomsky on your bookshelf and he eats through the other books. I think that's a hilarious way of looking at him. And I do have a lot of respect for him. I sit here in thanks to Chomsky. A lot of my knowledge, I mean, me and Hisham, both quite young, we've relied on Chomsky to a certain extent to ground ourselves politically and anchor ourselves and get our political direction. But there are elements where I think Chomsky is off the mark. I think he, specifically in this book, I think he sees the anti-war movement as something far more potent and powerful than it actually is. I think
wishful thinking rather than
I'd say that. I mean, particularly if you think about, well, in the lead up to Iraq, he sees that the unlike Vietnam, anti-war sentiment was there before violence ensued in any way, shape, or form. Although he does talk about how violence started in 2002 rather than 2003, but there was mobilized public opinion in relation to Iraq. But if we consider Libya right now and the interventions that our governments are engaged in and the anti-war movement and where they are, it's a damning indictment. And in fact, Chomsky, though he's got a chronicle of articles in here discussing the lead up to Iraq, has been relatively silent on Libya, as have much of the Western left. I think what we've seen in the past, what the book finishes its articles in 2008, in the past 3 years, we've seen an empire make a few moves and a reversal of that seeming power that the anti-war movement had.
Yeah. Hisham, what are you? Are you a fan?
Well, I certainly have huge amounts of respect for Professor Chomsky, and we have interviewed Chomsky on a number of occasions for our magazine, and the last time we did, in my introduction to the interview, I described him as the Bertrand Russell of our time. And I think this is a very, very important point to make, as I know Chomsky in terms of it's not just that his opinions are right. I mean, that's my opinion. He gets it right a lot of the time. I think his approach to things and his intellectual rigor in the way he does things is far more important than the opinions themselves. What Chomsky does is he tells us, for example, the importance of self-criticism, which is something that a lot of people pay lip service to, and they say, you know, we are self-critical and we're aware of our own, you know, the problems with our own thinking and prejudices, but very few people practice it. And I think Noam Chomsky has been really good at showing things like the hypocrisy that rules the American media and the American foreign policy establishment, in that they do things under certain pretexts, and he uncovers how the measure by which they do things is based on a hypocritical double standard, to say the least.
I mean, and some of his warnings turned out to be quite accurate. I mean, although, as you say, some of these earlier essays were written 4 or 5 years ago now, the things he was warning, the consequences he was warning about, actually did come to pass. So he's not necessarily off the mark. I mean, you could think of him as a sort of grumpy old man, but sometimes grumpy old men can be right, and a lot of the time he was proven right.
People forget that Noam Chomsky's activism started back in the 1960s.
Yeah.
And technically way before. His first article was on the fall of Barcelona, was written in the end of the 1930s.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is somebody who has been dedicating a lot of serious thinking to issues of our time. And it is true that maybe the tone of his message might strike some as a bit strident. It doesn't do for me. I think it's very clear to me if somebody takes the time to read his writings, especially the ones where he goes into book form rather than collections of articles.
I mean, a lot of his essays do cover the George Bush. Not all of it's about George Bush, but there are several essays about George Bush, who he clearly loathed, and you could understand why, coming from their perspective. But he was obviously quite optimistic when President Obama came to the throne, but actually the Obama policies haven't, I mean, the rhetoric's been softer than Bush, but have the actions been any softer than Bush? Do you think Chomsky must be a very disappointed man to see a liberal president who actually isn't delivering a liberal agenda?
I don't think Chomsky necessarily romanticised Obama. I think there's an article in there where he talks about John Kerry, and he sees it as a very unfair choice that the American electorate have between two candidates who are very much united in their social makeup, where they've come through, the institutions and the interests that they represent. It's very indicative that in the run-up to the 2008 election, Obama got more backing from corporations than John McCain did. So it was very clear that Obama was being controlled by and manipulated by, and who was in the act.
But he was a very left-wing senator, Obama. He had the most left-wing voting record in the Senate.
The Bush effect upon Obama, he left a legacy that Obama had to deal with, and I mean, it was very much pitched that Obama was this kind of liberal solution. But I think in retrospect, I think in viewing what the actual Bush legacy has been and what the hangover has been in America, I don't think it is necessarily something where we had this raving neocon in George Bush and we have this good-willed Obama who wants to do something but can't do any better. They are essentially two sides of the same coin. Yeah. And I think.
Do you think that, Hisham? Do you think it's?
Well, I mean,
clearly reviled Bush, didn't it? Just pours out. I mean, he's distaste and dislike
of course,
Bush.
But I think reviling, I mean, his position on Bush was fairly embraced by pretty much everyone by the end of the Bush presidency. Even people who used to be advocates of the Bush war in Iraq knew that by the end of the eighth year, they couldn't see the back of him. They couldn't wait to see the back of him. But when Obama was in the running, people asked Chomsky, they said, you know, should we vote for this guy? And he said, you know, vote for him, but without any illusions. And I think this is a very, very, very good point, is to say, when you have the option of voting for McCain or Obama, it is clearly a better option to go with Obama. But to have illusions of having this completely radical change of policy is simply not borne out by the facts. And he has been a very vocal critic of the Obama administration since. And I think the most important thing in terms of the significance of the Obama ascent in Chomsky's thinking is what it shows about the limits of the system. If somebody like Obama, who has all the right credentials, if we can speak so, in terms of his background and his
teaching, he's got the right instincts. But
exactly. Yeah, if somebody like him, with all this, I mean, you know, the popular image is that, you know, he does genuinely believe in fixing things and being a, you know, some sort of somebody who believes in human rights, somebody who believes in equality and so on. If somebody like him ends up the way he has ended and his presidency has gone, that what does that tell us about the system? The way things, the political system in the US, clearly that shows that no matter who with the best of intentions and with the best of people, it's still not going to be enough. What is needed is a drastic look at the way the system is functioning in the US and abroad and over, you know, the international system.
I suppose in a way, as Hisham says, it's a problem with the US system, where the founding fathers wanted checks on the presidency. Mm-hmm. So you get the Israeli prime minister visits the White House and Obama gives him a pretty cool hostile reception. He then mm-hmm. visits Congress, where he's given a standing ovation, and you mm-hmm. think, what's going on here? And that must be quite frustrating for a commentator like Chomsky, who would mm-hmm. want Obama to do well, but mm-hmm. he's a prisoner of Congress, really, isn't he? Mm-hmm.
I mean, Obama is a prisoner of the situation he finds himself in. I mean, we can all... I think what Obama says in Notes to My Father, I can't remember the exact phrase of the book title, but he says, I'm a blank canvas upon which people paint the politics they want to see. Right? And that's what people do with Obama. And Obama is, I mean, John Pilger describes him as a postmodern man. We look at Obama and we see what we want to see. We fill a vacuum, essentially. But what has Obama represented in office? We've seen a continuation of Bush's imperialism and a strengthening of imperial projects in Afghanistan, in Yemen, in Pakistan, in Libya. And so we're not watching as this humanitarian man tries to dismantle the neoconservative agenda. He's in fact added to it. He's kept Robert Gates as the defense secretary. He's cozied up with General Petraeus. We see a continuation of a neoconservative military agenda mm-hmm. and cuts at home. I mean, this again, Obama is in the White House. He is not acting on the interests of a complete different group. He's come through very much the same elite circles. Replicates that same systematic approach to American policy that we've seen with all presidents.
Well, let's just take a little break, because one of the things Chomsky addresses in here is the impact of America as a superpower. Where America stamps, it's a big vibration. But is it all going the American way, or do they have something to fear? Let's take a look at this extract from Chomsky's book and see what you make of it.
Regional integration in Asia and Latin America is a crucial and increasingly important issue that, from Washington's perspective, betokens a defiant world falling out of control. Energy, of course, remains a defining factor, the object of contention everywhere. China, unlike Europe, refuses to be intimidated by Washington. Primary reason for the fear of China by US planners. That presents a dilemma. Steps toward confrontation are inhibited by US corporate reliance on China as an export platform and growing market, as well as China's financial reserves.
So I suppose, Hisham, we had all those years where the Soviet bloc and the American Western bloc were sort of balancing one another. Then obviously the collapse of the Soviet Empire meant America was pretty unchallenged. But it's not going that way now, and I think Chomsky is touching a nerve, isn't he, for the State Department. What's your reading of that?
Well, I mean, I think the analysis that Chomsky offers is correct, and I think the planners of US foreign policy for the last half century always knew that there will be a continuous attempt to challenge this unipolar world they want to create and maintain. The US, you know, establishment wants the US to be the dominant power in the world, and they want to keep it that way. And of course they understand that this is not what the rest of the world wants, and there will be attempts, whether by the rise of Latin America or by the Chinese menace, as they see it, to overturn this dominance. And of course, their way to do it is to assert control over strategic, you know, prizes like the oil in the Middle East and so on, to give an example. And Chomsky's analysis is to say, we need to be aware of this bigger picture, which is that the US will do anything it can to keep its hegemony, to keep its dominance. And the China factor, in my view, I think will be very, very interesting to observe. I do not buy the simplistic approach that it's simply one country against another or one entity against another. I think there's a lot, I mean, as the passage mentions, there's a lot of interlinking business relationships between these two regions. Yeah. And what we might see is an alliance between the so-called, you know, the capitalist system in China with that in the US. That could be, this is, I think, a lot more in a dimension that's a lot more interesting to observe.
Yes, I mean, it's difficult. As economies develop, people often want a bit more say.
I think the economics would play a lot more part than the official, so to speak, rhetoric and politics. I mean, the economics of things, I mean, the American companies are all over China now. They're clearly investing billions of dollars in getting the Chinese market and getting implanted there. And it'll be interesting to see how this plays out and in whose favour.
But Africa is an interesting example of this, isn't it, Daniel? Because China has put a lot of effort into cultivating African governments, a lot of investment, and they want something back for that, mm-hmm. whereas America seems a sort of bit bored with Africa. So is America's imperial drive really an economic drive now, do you think, rather than a political drive?
I think that economically, what Chomsky talks about in this book is he talks about a tripolar world. I think we're beyond that. I think he himself acknowledges that without actually saying it. He talks about the tripolar world being US, Europe, and East Asia, when in fact he talks about the rising powers of Latin America and Lula as well within the book. So I think what we have to accept is that there's a multipolar global economic order, but there is a unipolar military order. And that unipolar military order has now landed in Africa, in North Africa, and is making moves around that area. I mean, there is no doubt Libya is an African nation. It is now being bombed daily by NATO. And there are talks, serious talks, about a ground invasion, though Robert Gates is warning against it and terrified because it looks like America are going to be stretched and it's potentially another war of attrition. Now, whether the Americans want to engage in a war of attrition in
North
Africa...
Is this just a sign of a superpower getting a little tired with everything, do you think, and
I think
wanting to be domestic rather than worrying about the world, or not really?
I think it's a superpower that has spent all of its time mm-hmm. building up a military, thinking that the way to supremacy... of global supremacy is military, and in fact, it's now been proved that economically you can achieve your goals through soft power, like China has done and continues to do. And unless the US does something drastic, which is what we see, I think, right now in North Africa and across the with these color revolutions that are very much supported and facilitated by Washington.
But I mean, the American military machine is a huge part of its fabric of society, not just economically, but the size of its sort of reservists and all of that. I mean, America is driven by its defense industry in many ways, isn't it?
Of course. I mean, this is not, you know, news. This is has always been the post World War to situation. It has been a world in which the military considerations rule everything else, and they in turn are related to the politics and economics of the interests of the American elite. And in terms of what's happening now, I think what is most interesting is how, I mean, of course, NATO has always been on the face of it and very openly a military force to protect the interests of the First World, so to speak, and you know, very brazenly goes, you know, is used as a tool to reassert control and stifle any attempts to break out of that control by other regions. And I think America's role in Africa should not be underestimated. It's true that China has taken an impressive lead in certain countries, but I think we should not forget that, for example, the AFRICOM initiative, where the US is trying massively to expand their military presence mm-hmm. in Western Africa under the pretext of the war on terror. But of course, a lot of the countries there are extremely alarmed, and they're trying to do their best to try and sort of fight this attempt by the US to essentially turn the region into yet another American base. And in terms of what I said about NATO, I think what is one of the most worrying implications of what happened in the last few months in the Arab world is the following. Everyone seems to forget that the UN has now been pushed to the fringe. And of course, you know, the UN, for all its faults, and it's by no means an adequate body, it's an extremely problematic institution. But it's, one could argue, it's the only thing we have. And it's the only thing that can possibly be turned into something that could stifle and keep under check.
I suppose, as Chomsky points out, the UN's been sort of pretty toothless about that other interesting military power. I mean, if you look at the way the Israeli economy has developed, mm-hmm. I mean, it's interesting that David Cameron said what the Israelis were doing by building their wall was creating, you know, the biggest prison camp in the world, and he was attacked mm-hmm. quite bitterly by that. Obama's been less enthusiastic about it all. Do you think Chomsky's warnings for Israelis were prescient in this, where this is a policy that just cannot work for them in the long term?
I think that what we've seen, and I think the sea change with perceptions of Israel in the last 10 years, particularly the last five, really, has been it is now a pariah state. And they are desperately trying to find some form of PR that they can roll out and win back the hearts of the liberal lefties that they've now lost. We can now talk openly about apartheid.
Yeah.
And the wall is a physical manifestation of an apartheid regime. It's very, very clear. It's a racial segregation line put there to imprison the Palestinians. There's a siege of Gaza that remains in place. The the Rafa opening is there, and once we get the PR search on our TV screens, but they're only allowing 500 people a day through, no commercial goods through, and no humanitarian aid. Once again, we have ships on the way to Gaza to try and help with the humanitarian situation, and they're being turned away. They're being told that they have to hand their goods over to the Israelis. We see this continuously, and it's very, very hard once you have this to actually have any semblance of anything that the liberals can cling on to try and go back to this perception of what Israel once represented.
And Chomsky does sort of highlight this, the way Israel likes to portray itself as a victim, as it were. You know, everybody's out to get us, everybody really hates us, the entire world is anti-Semitic, and yet it actually is quite an oppressive power. And I think Chomsky is quite brave in the way he tackles that, because that's not a message most people in North America want to hear, is it?
Of course, especially for him. I mean, a very famous, prominent Jewish American, somebody who has been a scholar of Hebrew since he was in his teens, whose father is a major authority on Hebrew. Yeah. So somebody who has all the, who cannot really be attacked from the anti-Semitic angle, to put it politely. And, he has been recently prevented entering Israel and was interviewed by Israeli TV. And people seem to say to him in Israel, why are you doing this against this country to whom you should show a lot, support? And he said, it's precisely because I care about some of the, about the people who live in the region that I'm doing this, because what the government of Israel, as Daniel has said correctly, we can now openly talk about apartheid, and for the last decade, I think Israel's actions have been completely irrational in a way, because it goes against the self-preservation, the basic self-interest of Israel is not being.
It's a good point to end on. The Chomsky's position is a good one. Thanks. I'm afraid that's all we've got time for. I found interventions a slightly dated polemic, but more recent developments simply add context and a degree of justification to this challenging book. Whether you agree with Chomsky's take on life or recoil at his prognosis, he does offer an intellectually rigorous analysis of US foreign policy and domestic pressures. I've reviewed Chomsky's work before, and he's always a stimulating read. I'd like to thank Daniel and Hisham for joining us, and I hope you've enjoyed the show. If you have a book you'd like the program to review, we'd like you to keep getting in touch, and here's how.
The Epilogue team want you to continue with your book review suggestions. You can email us at epilogue@presstv.co.uk. And don't forget to join our Facebook page. Enter Epilogue on Press TV into the search bar. You can watch past episodes, leave comments, and take part in discussions with other Epilogue fans.
Keep your feedback coming, and until next time, thanks for watching.